On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Star Wars is not the only media story of 2015, though it is a big one. Media stocks got a cold when ESPN sneezed. The continued fallout from the Sony hack may have made this the year of the woman, or not. There was peak TV, including a new crop of late-night hosts, and a certain politician who has pumped up the ratings wherever he goes. It's a Mega News Banter year in review, this week on The Business from KCRW. I'm here with my regular banter partners, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter and Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, fellows.
Hello.
Hi there.
So, the year that was, let's start with, well, an after effect, I would say, of the Sony hack, where it was revealed that Jennifer Lawrence was making less money than her co-stars in American Hustle, right?
Yep.
And significantly less. And that seemed to start a boulder rolling. And the boulder had to do with the underrepresentation of women in the industry in front of and behind the camera.
Yeah. I mean, it's the interesting thing is how much that started from just, you know, a piece of paper that was leaked in a hack to, by the end of 2015, we have, you know, Lifetime guaranteeing jobs to every female graduate of AFI and, you know, people coming out of the woodwork saying they're going to actually try to do something to rectify some of these appalling numbers on female directors.
Of course, the question is, what can be done? There's supposedly the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is looking into this. A group of people had a major meeting, you know, people like Jenji Cohen and various industry types, Hannah Minghella from TriStar. But really, the question is, you know, with all of these different entities hiring, you know, it's not just the studios, it's these production companies, which are contractors, which create sub-companies to produce a particular film. How do you get your arms around that legally? And Matt, you're a lawyer. I know you don't specialize in employment, but can that be done?
I think it's an uphill battle. I think because of the precious nature of the entertainment industry and the levels that are involved in hiring, I mean, you could fault the agencies for not creating a list that they send to the studios that includes women on it. You know, it's such a creative industry, it's going to be very difficult to pinpoint the exact place in the chain that is causing this imbalance. My opinion is that if change is going to come, it's going to have to come from a desire on the part of the industry to make a change and the pressure being put on it both by the media and by prominent people like Jennifer Lawrence and like Jenji Cohen, those type of people, and Catherine Hardwicke, directors who have spoken out about this issue.
Well, let's look at compare film to television.
That's, you know, what I
because,
was just going to ask
yeah,
you.
Yeah, film could learn a lot from television, obviously. While this has been an ongoing debate on the film side, you know, television is experiencing a real boom in terms of, you know, diversity, representation, not just of, you know, more women on screen and behind the camera, but also African-Americans, Latinos, Asian-Americans. The past 2 years have been a real explosion in terms of what we've seen in front of and behind the camera on television. You know, shows like Empire and Fresh Off the Boat this year were two of the buzziest, most popular new shows that the networks premiered. And so there's been a real growth, and that's been one of the real positive stories is how organic this has all now been happening on the TV side. These are shows that are real good shows created and produced by huge talent like Shonda Rhimes, like Jenji Cohen, like Melissa Rosenberg, some real strong female.
That would be, let's running through the shows, Shonda Rhimes, obviously the Thursday night lineup on ABC, Jenji Cohen, Orange is the New Black, and Melissa Rosenberg.
From Jessica Jones on Netflix. And that's just like, you know, touching the surface of all the great talent that is now, you know, really running shows, really leading the industry now. And it also comes down from, you know, great executives, female and minority executives in television. television who are, you know, helping shape the future of television. So, yeah, look at what TV's
doing.
Well,
film is the opposite. As we know, Colin Trevorrow directed one small movie, Safety Not Guaranteed, and then, boom, makes a leap to Jurassic World. Same thing with Josh Trank. He did Chronicle and a much less successful leap to Fantastic Four. But I can't remember where I read a line that said, when women do a small successful movie, people say, wow, what a great indie career this woman is going to have. And when men do it, they're being handed these gigantic franchises. The other thing I'll just mention is, I just heard Kathy Kennedy, who runs Lucasfilm, interviewed, and she said that no one had approached her about a woman to direct one of the Star Wars movies. And she felt that, while there is a tremendous problem of sexism and gender inequity, she felt that, maybe there also needs to be a bigger push by people to say, I want to do this. I don't know if that's fair, but that is what she said. Let's turn for a moment to another major story of the past year. This is the fight over Viacom. Sumner Redstone, as we have discussed on the show before, he is 92 years old. He apparently can barely make himself understood verbally. That doesn't seem to be in dispute. What is in dispute is whether this person, who is the executive chairman of both Viacom, which includes Nickelodeon and MTV and a major
Paramount
media empire, as well as Paramount Pictures, yes, and also CBS, run by Leslie Moonves, very capably, much more performing much better than Viacom under Philippe Domon. But Sumner Redstone is supposed to be in charge, and the question has come into full view in court: is he mentally competent?
Yeah, I mean, his former companion Manuela Herzer, who was with him for anywhere from 15 to 18 years, she has sued, saying that he's not competent and that she should be reinstated as his legal guardian and legal caretaker because she was forcibly removed from his estate earlier this year. In the meantime, Philippe Domon, the CEO of Viacom, has been anointed as the caretaker officially, and he says Sumner's fine, and he has conversations with him all the time, and he's perfectly capable of running the company. So I think this is one of those things that's going to, it's a big deal this year. It's going to be an even bigger deal in 2016 as this lawsuit plays out, and as, the battle for what's going to happen post-Sumner Redstone kind of kicks up.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Manuela Herzer did as she's going in this court fight is to submit under seal a tape recording of Sumner Redstone. And we can only speculate what is on that tape, but obviously it's going to go to her point that he does not have conversations with Philippe Domon or anybody else that are necessarily coherent. Whether that will be unsealed in the course of this litigation is certainly unclear. And the other point, she is going after Philippe Domon, questioning his veracity, really, which, considering that he is in fact running Viacom, is kind of potentially a big deal if that gets, if this proceeds much further and there's no settlement.
And it's not just her. They're the second largest shareholder of Viacom went
exactly
public saying that more information should be revealed about the health status of Sumner Redstone because the shareholders deserve to know.
That's Mario Gabelli, yeah. So that is something we absolutely will want to watch. I will note that one of the weak points, we mentioned that Paramount is part of the Viacom empire. It has not performed too strongly this past year. We are dealing in a time of feast and famine, Matt, as you well know, where you've got Disney rolling into the theaters with Star Wars and not just Star Wars. I mean, they've got Pixar, they've got Marvel. They, as somebody, an executive at another studio said to me, they won movies. Not this year. I should mention Universal is the number one for the year with movies like 50 Shades of Grey and the Fast and Furious franchise. But Disney is overall the most powerful franchise owner in the business. And other people, like other studios, like Paramount and Sony, not so good.
I think what you're seeing here is a feast or famine, highs and lows at the box office like we've never seen before. On the one side, you have Star Wars and Jurassic World, both of which have record openings for their time. And then on the low side, I mean, you have these big studio movies that open on 2,000 screens or more and are grossing less than $5 million. You had Mordecai, which was a Johnny Depp comedy that grossed $4.2 million in its open weekend. You had The Walk, which Sony had high hopes for, opened to just $3.7 million in its opening weekend. Movies like Our Brand is Crisis, the Sandra Bullock movie that opened earlier this year and just completely flopped, $3.2 million. There was another movie, Gem and the Holograms, which was supposed to be a teen-friendly young girl type movie, $1.4 million in an opening weekend that went wide. Those are numbers that are so low that people in Hollywood are looking at it saying, wow, you can't just release a movie anymore. Social media and word of mouth and the consumer is so savvy that these movies are dead on Friday if they're not good.
Parallel to that, you know, we're talking about how, you know, Viacom and Paramount struggling on the film side. You know, one of the narratives also is struggling on the cable side. You know, speaking of Viacom and the issues that they have right now, their cable properties, and not just theirs, many others too, suffering some real big declines this year. We're seeing the true erosion of basic cable. For example, Viacom Networks, MTV, from an 18 to 49 perspective, they're down 29% this year. VH1, down 10%. Comedy Central, which lost Jon Stewart and some, you know, big talent this year, down 20%. So it's, you know, a real big issue right now for cable as well.
This is something that's been predicted for a long time. As cord cutting happens and streaming services happen, this kind of thing has been in the making.
Oh, it's a mix of problems. I mean, there's that, but then there's also the loss of a lot of great talent and some, you know, not a lot of new shows that are really hitting at these networks. And it's
well, certainly when your comments about MTV and Comedy Central go back to Philippe Delmon and how well is he managing
that
company.
So the perfect storm of problems.
Yeah, and you know, I will mention that one of the crises of the past year for the entertainment companies was when ESPN showed wobble in its subscriber numbers. And the entire media world took a lashing in terms of stock value.
Yeah, I mean, cord cutting, you know, we've been talking about it for years. It's still not predominant. It's not, you know, the death knell for broadcast or cable. But at the same time, you've seen some real declines in subscriber rolls. So ESPN, for example, you know, they're down to 92 million subscribers, which is huge. But, you know, a few years ago, they had 99 million subscribers. And you're seeing that across the board with many networks. But ESPN is threatening in general because, you know, that's the one network that seems sort of, you know, cord-cutting proof. You know, it's live sports.
Live sports. You can't postpone it.
The other thing is they have run up the price of live sports so much over
That's
the past
true.
Decade, where the cost structure of ESPN is so high now because they pay so much for NFL football, Major League Baseball, all of these very big ticket sports items that they have to get a lot of money in revenue in order to keep that going.
So yeah. They charge a lot, and people say, I don't know if I need it that badly, I guess.
And one number that one hedge fund manager put out was they predict that ESPN's lost $900 million a year the past 2 years just because of that drop in subscribers. And you saw them do some layoffs this year. They laid off about 300 people, about 4% of their workforce. So it's you know, as irrational the reaction was on Wall Street to this news, it's nonetheless, you know, a true issue and
sort
a true
of
problem.
Irrationally irrational. Yeah.
You know, one thing that's interesting, though, is I think it dovetails with this whole issue of peak TV and, you know, whether there is too much scripted TV out there. Because as these cable companies get more competitive with each other, they're all in this arms race to have breakout shows. And, you know, FX put out a report showing there were more than 400 scripted TV series on the air this year. I mean, that is so much content and it's so expensive to produce and there's so much of a battle for viewers that I think it's really, there's going to be a shakeout at some point.
Yeah, and Matt, you know, that number, which was 409, a new record, mm-hmm. You know, that's up 9% even from 2014 when the number was 376. And honestly, you know, if you go back even 10 years ago, that number was in the 200 range. So it's been a big explosion. And that number doesn't even include reality, news, sports, made-for-TV movies, specials, children's programming. You add it all up, and there's thousands of hours of original programming across the board. Can this industry sustain it? That's what John Landgraf at FX is asking.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm drowning in media. All I keep hearing is that Fargo, the second season, was one of the best things ever on television.
Oh, it was. It was. It was great this year.
It's been sitting on my living room, the whole set, since before it was even on television, and I can't find, between the movies I have to watch for work and the TV shows, I can't even tell you. I have a trove of media, and I can't even begin to get through it.
And this is our job. I mean, we are in this world. I mean, imagine, like, average person who is trying to sift through this stuff and saying, oh, I hear this show on Sci-Fi is amazing. Oh, I hear this. Like, it's just impossible to keep up.
Well, see, I think it's fine for the average person. I mean, it's a high-class problem. So, you know, they basically have this amazing sort of pool of shows. They can watch whatever they want. It's like going to a library or to a bookstore. It's the business that's really going to have to, you know, have a come to Jesus moment because, you know,
well, that's true. Because how do you know?
There's a finite amount of ad dollars, as we know, and as we just mentioned, subscriber numbers are going down. So ultimately, that means ad rates go down, CPMs go down, and so, you know, there will be a moment where these cable networks say this is ridiculous.
Well,
we
already had John Landgraf on the show. He runs FX and FXX and whatever the else is. There's another
FFFFXXX.
Yeah, whatever. I'm sorry,
you don't want that channel.
I'm sure they're very good.
Oh, no, you do want that channel, Matt.
But he was bemoaning the fact that what he considers to be really good shows just die because they're not good enough to break through this insane amount of clutter.
Oh, and he's frustrated because he did have a number of new shows this year that they put a lot of effort into, including The Bastard Executioner, the new show from Kurt Sutter.
Kurt Sutter, who did Sons of Anarchy.
Died on the vine. And, you know, you could argue that's because there's too much TV or maybe it just wasn't a good show.
Well, that's the entertainment business.
Even
you never
Fargo,
know. Yeah.
Even Fargo's ratings are not gigantic. And, you know, in another era, a show like that probably would have been a huge breakout.
It could have been like The Sopranos of its...
Americans. That's another amazing show on FX, and it does fine, but it's always on the brink of cancellation, despite all the attention.
And meanwhile, you look at the streaming services and the amount of volume that a Netflix, which literally almost every weekend now premieres a new show, a new expensive movie quality
and
show.
And Amazon has a bunch of shows. And now Hulu, right? Everybody's getting into the originals game. It's almost like as it becomes more difficult, more players are coming.
And that's why it drives people like Landgraf nuts that they're not rated by Nielsen, because they basically, so far, seem to be able to, you know, they have an unending amount of money to produce and distribute all these shows.
We do not know how many people are watching these shows, and it's lots of people would love to know. They always claim it's a lot. We don't know that.
I disagree a little bit on the sense of whether the viewer is fine about this, because I do believe that when Netflix is introducing a new show every week and there's so much content and it does overwhelm you, I think it's going to give incentives for people to just cut themselves off from certain services. And, you know, if they're not watching as much on their cable platform as they are on Netflix, people are just going to get rid of cable.
Well, I think that is absolutely. I mean, our TV, one of our TV critics at The Hollywood Reporter, both of them, but one of them, Daniel Feinberg, came up with one that was only 10 shows, and there were a couple I had literally never heard of. And as you point out, Matt, this is our job. And this is like a top 10 show for this critic.
Yeah, you can't do a top 10 list anymore. You got to do a top 30 list.
Well, I think that's necessary. But the amazing thing is they sort of fall through the cracks. However, I just will mention in the awards, we're not nearly through the awards season yet. But we, as we've talked about, Mike, some of these shows, including Hulu and, you know, Amazon, are breaking through and in the awards arena. And really, all of these nominations that, you know, Amazon is represented, Netflix is represented, and now even Hulu. It's changing the game.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's making the TV awards shows look a lot like the movie awards shows, which is the
relentless
nominees. Well, and also the nominees are titles that you've never heard of before. So, Casual from Hulu, which is actually a nice little show, but not a lot of people have heard of it, got a big nomination at the Golden Globes, for example.
Yeah, you really wonder how that happened. If you
look at the media and you look at the awards, Transparent is the biggest thing out there. But I'm wondering how many people are actually watching Transparent.
I would imagine the answer is really not that many, but Amazon's not going to tell us.
No, and it doesn't matter to them because all it does is help them sell socks. If enough people are hearing about Amazon and going on Amazon Prime, they've said that at the goal. That Jeff Bezos did an interview with us earlier this year. He said, this is essentially a lost leader for us. We want to have a robust content offering that drives people to the Prime service, which ultimately leads them to buy more socks.
Although in my case, it's like soap, dog food. But yeah,
dog
I take
food,
your point.
That's the big one.
Coming up after a short break, a new landscape in late night, and Trump pumps the ratings. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW's popular iPad Music Mine app is now available for the iPhone. From quick discovery to deep exploration, take KCRW Music with you wherever you go. Download at kcrw.com/musicmine.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Today, we're taking stock of the industry as we wrap up 2015. I'm here with my regular banter buddies, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter and Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. And one of the events of the year that was the bankruptcy filing of Relativity. This is Ryan Kavanaugh's company. Ryan Kavanaugh, very high-flying guy, literally with his helicopter flying around L.A., you know, a huge personality, seemed to have, I don't know, more than nine lives with financing and movies that really didn't work. I mean, this is a company that has been truly hit-starved for years. For a while there, Ryan Kavanaugh was teamed up with Universal, and you know, things were okay when he was being brought in to help finance their films. Then he went out on his own. He told the world he had a wonderful formula for making hit movies. He had a wonderful computer program, I think, a model for predicting hits. This is not a thing that exists, as far as anyone. It certainly didn't exist for Relativity. And then they really were one of the more spectacular bankruptcies in recent industry history, certainly, Matt, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I think a lot of people in Hollywood had been waiting for years.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of karma out there, and people are saying, okay, you got a guy running around town claiming to have reinvented the movie business, and yet when these movies come out, they don't seem to make very much money. And he claimed that they didn't need to make money because his formula had accounted for foreign pre-sales, and, you know, finally it all came crashing down, and there was a bankruptcy filing earlier this year, and Ryan Kavanaugh was not happy about that. He claims still that he had been bamboozled by some of his investors who tricked him into essentially giving the keys to the company away, and now he's been forced into bankruptcy, and it's still playing out in court in New York.
Yeah, he seems to be constantly having a skirmish and trying to, you know, he's had to get rid of his sell-off, the one part of the company that seemed to be working, the TV division, and the film division, which is, you know, I mean, there were spectacular losses that racked up into the hundreds of millions of dollars. Once the bankruptcy was filed, it became clear just how bad it was, which everybody suspected, but nobody knew. The only thing people, I think, liked about Relativity is that Hollywood could always use buyers. There's all these agents and writers and people out there looking for an opportunity. And if the other studios weren't interested, maybe Relativity would be. So they don't like to see a buyer fall by the wayside. But in Ryan Kavanaugh's case, you know, they may be willing to make an exception.
Yeah, and the problem that you have now is that there are a lot of films that are caught up in this bankruptcy, and they are either being shuttled to other studios or just kind of languishing, and producers are essentially stuck with a movie company in bankruptcy that has their film. So this kind of a thing is not just bad for Ryan Kavanaugh, it brings down a lot of other people as well.
Yeah, and there's a ripple effect, and a lot of people who have, you know, have not had their bills paid, vendors are also involved. So it is a really a giant mess. Speaking of people with orange hair, I'm sorry to do this, orange-haired bloviators, Donald Trump has had an impact on not just this election, but TV.
Oh, it's been all over the map. Donald Trump, whatever he touches, strangely enough, turns to gold. I mean, he
from
goes
a
on from a rating standpoint. Saturday Night Live, he goes on, gives them their best numbers in a while. He'll go on Fallon or Colbert or even most recently Jimmy Kimmel and gave him some of his best numbers in a while. It's the Trump effect continues to have just this amazing effect, not just on those shows, but of course the debates, which these have been the highest rated primary debates in history.
If you had told me earlier this year that a political debate on Fox News would generate 23 million viewers and be one of the highest rated shows of the summer, I would have said, no way. But, you know, Donald Trump enters the race, and that was compelling television. These are now entertainment broadcasts. They're not political broadcasts.
Yeah, it's like the cable networks have an addiction to this guy, and they have pundits saying, like, why is Donald Trump so successful at the same time that they're programming him, like, 24-7?
And there's such a TV angle to this as well. There have been studies that Donald Trump's time as the host of The Apprentice on NBC did have an effect, a significant effect, according to one study that David Axelrod from CNN did, in that sort of it softened his image among some potential voters. It really put him in the limelight for most of the 2000s and sort of gave him a new sort of vaunted position in pop culture. And that sort of had a real impact. So I think we do have Jeff Zucker partly to blame.
the former head of NBC.
Yes, for all of this. And of course, then there was the big story of NBC actually firing him from Celebrity Apprentice and also parting ways with the Miss Universe organization. Even that turned out well for Donald Trump. He managed to take back the portion that, you know, he co-owned the pageants with NBC. He took back that portion and then immediately turned it around and sold it to WME IMG for a profit as well. So it's been a very interesting year for Donald Trump.
One of the interesting aspects of the Trump phenomenon is also his ability to both manipulate and engage with the media unlike any other candidate. I mean, the fact that he was openly feuding with Fox News earlier this year and calling out, you know, Megyn Kelly, whether or not he made a derogatory comment or not, then became secondary stories. And he is, in a sense, dictating a lot of terms to these networks, many of which do not allow political candidates to phone into their shows, except Donald Trump, who can apparently phone into almost any show that he wants to and get time on the air. So this is a very, very unique presidential candidate that the media doesn't quite know what to do with.
Now, meanwhile, we mentioned he's made the rounds at all the late night shows. The late night landscape has been another big story this year. It's transformed. Jon Stewart, I'm going to try and say this without my voice breaking, gone from The Daily Show, and Trevor Noah in, Colbert now running The Late Show, it's on CBS, and James Corden really, you know, lighting up the internet with a lot of great videos from the post-Late Show, Late Late Show.
and so far, the big victor remains Jimmy Fallon.
Who, unbelievably unstoppable.
His clips are seen by millions on YouTube. He gets the hottest stars to do the most interesting things. You know, these shows have really turned into variety shows. They're entertainment shows now, with Fallon leading the pack. But Corden, as you mentioned, came on strong. Someone who was not a household name a year ago.
At all, yeah.
Is managing to do quite an interesting show at 12:35 every night on CBS.
And Trevor Noah is doing, I think, okay, replacing Jon Stewart, but not, yeah, given that who Jon Stewart was and that Trevor Noah is not particularly known. But Larry Wilmore is kind of, I think, struggling in that former Colbert slot.
Well, both of those shows are obviously down, you know, huge double digits, as you would expect. You can't replace Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and not expect a big decline. So, you know, they have suffered these massive double-digit losses. You know, both are chugging along. You know, both have had some interesting moments. Larry Wilmore, as you mentioned, one of the big topics this year, obviously, was Black Lives Matter and the ongoing issue of, you know, police and African Americans. That's been an important issue that Larry's been able to really tackle like no other host has been able to do this year.
To me, the big story is Stephen Colbert and the kind of show that he is doing. He has essentially said, I am not going to compete with Jimmy Fallon. It's almost like he has acknowledged that he is going to be second or third place and is doing a more cerebral show. He's having guests on that are not traditional late night guests. We've seen politicians, CEOs. I saw a ballerina one night. There is a choice that he made to do a particular type of show, and it is not the kind of show that typically wins the late night ratings.
And he's pulling in a younger audience than, you know, previously with Letterman, and I think CBS is gonna be okay with that.
Yeah, for now at least. I think he's still, more than anyone else, still finding his way, and I think obviously part of that is, you know, he played this character for so long, and he's still sort of adjusting to how much of that character is him and how much isn't it. That's a show that I think will really, 5 years from now when we check in, is going to look completely different from the show that we see now. I think the other shows, Corden, Fallon, Kimmel, will all look pretty much the same, but it's 5 years from now, who can predict what Colbert is going to look like? And that's fine. You know, these shows evolve. These are long games. These are marathons. So we'll see.
And of course, we do have at least a couple of people of color in Trevor Noah and Larry Wilmore, but still no women in Late Night. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter and Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. And that's The Business for 2015. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week and next year on The Business.